I don't know if you saw this, but as of this recording, what is it? 24th of March? Probably can't see that, but.
What does it say? It's our YouTube.
1K.
Oh, shit. 1,000 subscribers.
Man. Moving on up. Moving on up.
Oh, I made that one of our goals for the year, so now I get to color it in.
That was a goal from the beginning. We talked about that, because that's what you need to monetize, right? 1,000?
I thought it was 2,000. I'm not sure. We'll have to look.
If it's 2,000, that's, like, as hopeful as I was 5 seconds ago, now I'm like, 2,000? How long it took us almost a year to get to 1,000.
I do love crushing your dreams.
Well, success.
Yes! Yeah.
What is up, crime crew? Welcome back to another episode of Murder Unscripted, the most immersive true crime podcast available on the interwebs today. I'm your host, Ed Hydock. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, along with my bestie, my partner in crime, Melissa Spivey.
Heyo.
Melissa, we are in a new month. What a month that sport, that March Madness block was. We had some crazy stories and talked to Tanya Brown. We talked to Patrick Dennehy's family, which was awesome as well. It was a cool month.
It was. We got a lot done. We talked to really cool people. It was a great month.
Completely agree. So now it's April of 2025, though, which means spring, which I am so excited about because I feel like my body is finally thawing out after
that
bitter cold winter.
It was kind of crappy today, though.
It was. It was raining today. But you know what? It's not like bone chilling like it usually is.
That's true.
Well, new month, and we have a new theme this month. You want to tell everybody what it is?
Absolutely. Our theme this month is spring cleaning.
Yes, it is. So it's time to crack open the windows, let some fresh air in, start that spring cleaning. And in the spirit of spring cleaning, we chose to clean out our email inbox. And since Melissa has never cleaned anything in her life except her plate.
Okay. Excuse me. That depends on if there's chicken nuggets on that plate or not. If so, then yes, it is clean. Picked clean.
I have a newfound appreciation for chicken nuggets. I'm just saying, I'm going through a phase.
me too. It's called the last 37 years of my life.
Yeah, your phase is not going to end anytime soon, I don't think.
Never.
So, well, I cleaned out our inbox and I went through all of our listener suggestions that we've gotten. And this month we'll be covering the cases that you guys sent us.
You guys sent us some really good ones. And we picked some of like the lesser known cases to focus on. But keeping that in mind, as you may know or do know or may not know, but we are starting this week. We will be releasing shorter episodes. They're going to come out every Friday in our new segment entitled MU Minis. And these will be five. What?
No, I just said as in.
Oh, I thought you were going.
No, that was more of a.
Okay, sorry. We are going to start releasing twice a week. So we'll have our normal regular length Tuesday episodes. And then every Friday, we're going to be releasing a much shorter 5 to 10 minute like mini episode. And in these little clips, we'll give you, you know, the straight facts of a case. And of course, it's going to relate to our monthly theme.
Yeah, it's going to be a nice way to kind of supplement our main show with just some the people who like shorter retellings. Maybe you don't have an hour to dedicate to learning about a case, but you want to hear some more cases that fit our theme in a short amount of time. And the goal of it is we're really trying to get the word out about some more cases, not just the four or five that we cover in a month, but maybe these are cases that we don't have a ton of information on, or maybe ones that are still open, or people are just trying to get the word out about something. So it's kind of a way for us to share some of these more obscure stories, or maybe ones that don't have closure or have never gotten the publicity they deserve. So make sure you hit that like and subscribe button, because you know, you don't want to miss any of that content. We've got some good stuff coming up. So with that housekeeping out of the way, Melissa, what do you have for us today? I think it's a doozy from what I'm understanding.
It is, but wait, hold on. We got to tell everyone about our guest this month, because leaning into our theme of listener suggestions, our special interview guest this month is one of you.
It's crazy. And that's how this theme was born, because someone reached out to us. Her name was Shannon Byers, not to be confused with Shannon Myers Barrientos, who was one of our Survivor guests. But Shannon Byers reached out, and she is one of the, she found us on Reddit, believe it or not, a while ago. So she's listened to every episode, big fan, and it's always nice. We've been connecting now for a couple months, talking back and forth. And she has a pretty incredible story to share with you guys. And I don't want to give too much away, but Shannon was an investigator with the Gwinnett County Medical Examiner's Office in Georgia. She kind of wrote in with a topic idea, and I'm like, man, that's a really interesting topic, but how do we tell stories that fit that mold? So the plan is just to make Shannon a guest on her own. She's going to stand alone and tell her story.
Shannon's wonderful. We love talking to her. Mm-hmm. And I'm really looking forward to hearing her story. And I love the idea of kind of coming at true crime from like a different angle. Like, mm-hmm. obviously the victim is always the heart of all these stories, but there's just so many other people who like play a part in the process, and to hear from someone who has been part of that process, I mean, it's absolutely a privilege, and it's also so important that these people are recognized.
It's true, and we talk about the ripple effect of cases. So this is going to be an example of that.
All right, well, that is coming up, but for now, I am super excited to tell you about our case today. And listeners, I cannot keep a secret to save my life, so don't ever commit a crime with me. But while Ed doesn't generally know everything about the cases that I share with you, he also isn't usually completely in the dark. But this episode is so crazy, go nuts, bananas, that I had to keep it under wraps because I want like your genuine reactions. So today's episode was sent in by Rosie A. from Florida. So Rosie, thank you.
Thank you, Rosie.
Yay. So I knew a little bit about this case, but I had absolutely no idea what I was in for. My sources for today include an incredibly amazing and detailed Vanity Fair article entitled The Case of the Vanishing Blonde, and that was written by Mark Bowden. And I also watched a 2-hour special episode of 2020, but I can't tell you the name of it yet because that's going to give away my case. So okay. With that being said, let's get started. So we're 11-ish months into this podcast, so I think you know how I normally present a case, but contrary to that, this is not going to be heavy in victimology, because to be honest, there isn't much out there about our victim. This episode, which is going to be a 2-part episode, is really heavy on the investigative side of things. It is a roller coaster of a case, so buckle in. Our case takes place mostly in Miami, Florida, but as you'll see, we're going to be all over the place with this case. And we're going to rewind back to a simpler time. AKA 2005.
It was a simpler time.
It was, wasn't it? I was still in high school.
I don't know what I was doing. I was married. First time.
The first time. Moving on. All right. So it's February 21st, 2005, to be exact. And it's a little after 8 a.m. And a utility worker is surveying this undeveloped cul-de-sac in like the western suburbs of Miami, Florida. And we're talking like really the outer fringe, like almost in like Everglades territory than the actual city of Miami. So as I said, this cul-de-sac is part of a new residential development, but like they hadn't gotten to this section of the land yet to build the new homes. So the landscape is still pretty overgrown. So this utility worker, he's actually a power company worker. He's doing whatever he's out there to do. When he sees something in the grass, and as he gets closer, he is horrified to discover the naked body of a woman. She's bloody and clearly battered. She's face down in the dirt and grass, and like her beautiful long blonde curls are all tangled in the weeds.
I've actually heard about cases like this where people are dumped in these kind of areas that are being developed, because it makes a great dumping ground because they're not developed. You know, it means they're usually just abandoned at night. But at the same time, you have to know that people are going to come back in the morning. So it's not, it doesn't seem like a long-term solution to me. If I were going to dump a body, I don't know if I would do it in a place that people were going to be, you knew people would be back in the morning to continue working if I were trying to hide that for a long period of time.
No, that's true. Although I'm wondering if maybe our perp like didn't know the area. So he's like, oh, there's an empty field. Like
maybe work. That could be true too.
Well, as this poor power worker is trying to mentally process this scene, he realizes the brutalized body that lay before him, she's alive. Barely, whoa, but she's alive.
Nice.
Yeah, so police and paramedics are called, and they arrive shortly after, and our unconscious Jane Doe is quickly airlifted to the Ryder Trauma Center at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami. And she actually remains unconscious for about the next day, like 24 hours or so. No. So police are on site and they begin investigating immediately, led by Detective Alan Foote of the Miami-Dade PD, specifically the Sex Crimes Division.
Why sex crimes? Was she raped?
So she was. We'll get there in a second. But yes, okay, there is evidence of rape.
Okay.
So the first thing they need to figure out is, who is our Jane Doe? They go to the hospital, and while they don't find out her identity right away, they are informed of her injuries. And honestly, like, these investigators are stunned that Jane Doe is still alive. She had been violently raped, brutally beaten, and left for dead. Just some of her, like, long list of injuries include multiple orbital fractures, which essentially means that her right eye socket was completely shattered.
Yeah, just smashed.
Yeah. Oof. She had severe head trauma. When they bring her in, she's like in a neck brace and she's got this swollen jaw. She's all these facial lacerations and her poor body is just like a giant bruise.
God damn. How did she survive?
I have no idea. But investigators are hoping beyond hope that Jane Doe not only wakes up, but wakes up to help them figure out her identity and also what happened to her.
Right.
So until she wakes up, though, Detective Foote and his team, they're like, well, we got to do something. They don't want to waste any time. So they begin by investigating the crime scene, that empty lot, which is pretty fruitless. It's clear that the crime didn't take place there. This was just a dumping ground. So then they start looking through recently called in missing persons reports, which is another dead end. And then they decide to go door to door in the area where Jane Doe is found. But remember, the specific area was still undeveloped, and like the parts of the neighborhood that did have homes, a lot of them were still empty.
Mm-hmm.
So police talked to who they could, but they were still no closer to even figuring out Jane Doe's name, let alone what happened to her and who did it. The next day, Detective Foote gets a phone call. Jane Doe is awake.
Nice.
Yes. So Foote races over to the hospital, and the bad news is our girl can't talk. But the good news is that she can write.
Hmm.
So she writes her name down for police, Ina, I-N-N-A, Ina Buninska. She continues to write down that she's from Ukraine. And just an FYI, like there is a bit of a language barrier. Her English is very broken. But she's still able to write a few questions down. So she writes things like, what happened to me and where did you find me? And the last thing she writes down is the name Mitchell Lipcomb, who happens to be her attorney. And this immediately raises red flags for police, because if she's a victim, why would she need a lawyer?
Two thoughts. I would think that she's either uttering the name of her killer, like whether it's an attorney, you know, she's saying this is who killed me, or maybe there's something else going on in her life and this attorney knows what the police need to know. Like, go see him and you'll find out everything you need to know.
Well, you're not too far off base with one of your theories.
Which one?
We'll get there. So right. First, police are wondering if Jane Doe is like caught up in something. They're like, she gave us the name of her lawyer. Like, is this a drug thing? Is she a sex worker? Is she part of a trafficking ring? But when they call this Mitchell Lipcon, they find out that the real story was much less tantalizing. It turns out that Ina had been working for one of like the big cruise lines and she was injured on the job. I guess this was while they were out at sea. Apparently she cut her finger pretty severely. So the cruise line was putting her up in the Airport Regency Hotel while she healed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So during that time, she had brought a civil case against the cruise ship due to her injury. And the lawyer whose name she had provided to police was the one representing her in the case against the cruise line. And luckily, he is able to explain to the police that he's pretty much the only person that Ina really knows in the area. Like, she's thousands of miles from home in the Ukraine, and any coworkers that she may have befriended, like, they're off at sea because the cruise ship is out sailing away.
Yeah.
And she's just basically staying at this random hotel in a random United States city. So the lawyer thing finally kind of makes sense to police, at least for now.
And that does make sense. And honestly, it makes a case so much harder to investigate because a lot of the answers that police need come from a person's victimology and their loved ones. So when there is none, it definitely adds like another hurdle for these cops.
100%. And as you're going to see, this entire case is a gajillion hurdles that are on fire. So when Ina is able to describe her account of what happened that night, this just really leads to more questions and even a bit of skepticism on the investigator's part. So over the next few weeks, Ina's story keeps changing. First, she believes she was attacked in her hotel room, which, by the way, was on the fourth floor of the hotel. And she says she was attacked by two men, maybe three men, or maybe it was just one man. And The men were white, but they had accents, and they might have been Hispanic accents. But then later, she thinks maybe they were Romanian accents.
Man, she's all over the place.
She is. And she goes on to tell investigators that she has memories of being forced to drink something very potent. And then she was carried, or maybe she was like flung over someone's shoulder, or she might have been dragged to this car where she was violently raped. So the next thing she can remember is waking up on the ground and it being dark and cold. But then she lost consciousness again because the next memory she has is waking up in the hospital. So like she's in the 2020 episode and she describes her account as more like flashes of things happening. And some of it, she can't tell if it's a dream or if it was real life. And between how it keeps changing and, of course, the language barrier, this gives police even more questions.
Yeah, I mean, me too. I mean, it sounds like getting the story of who broke the window from one of your kids, you know? I mean, it's this poor girl, though. It's like the head trauma thing, too. You never know what that can do to somebody and how that can affect what they're trying to convey. And then, yeah, you're absolutely right. The language barrier, too. So, like, this is, it's kind of a stacked deck against police.
Absolutely. And I mean, I'm sure they're at the point, they're like, where do we even begin?
I would think the hotel. Like, you just, at that point, when you have nothing, you know at least where she was staying, so we'd probably start there.
Well, you're right. That's exactly what Detective Foote does. So he goes to the Airport Regency Hotel, which this is about 8 miles, like, from where Ina was found in that undeveloped lot. So Foote asks about Ina, and the hotel staff is able to confirm her story. The cruise line incident, she had been living there, etc. And according to sources, Ina had been staying there at least a few months, so like, of course they're going to recognize her. So Detective Foote and his team, they do a survey of like the entire hotel, and they discover that there are only two points of entry to this hotel. There's the front doors, which are in the main lobby, and then the back doors. And like, the entire back of the hotel is completely fenced in. So there's really only two ways that people, employees included, can get in and out of the hotel. And both of these doors have overnight security officers providing access control. And both doors have security cameras pointed right at them.
You know, what's interesting is when we look for cases now on these TV shows, 2000 is like the cutoff because we find that you have a better chance of having like videotaped interrogations. You have working these high-tech security cams. You can start to like get more more visual elements that are really appealing to audiences, like seeing that authentic footage. But 2000, for whatever reason, seems to be the cutoff. And I know we just talked about in the Patrick Dennehy case in our Time Machine about how 2003 was the year that every phone had a camera on it. So there might just been a technological revolution starting in the year 2000.
So police ask the hotel people, you know, about the security footage, and they find out that this hotel actually has a very sophisticated and very extensive security camera network. So in the 2020 episode, the vice president of the airport regency, a man named Jose Vasquez, he's interviewed. And he confirms that at least at the time when, you know, stayed there, they had 60 security cameras. I feel like that's a lot.
You got to cover a lot of places to cover.
Yeah. Well, and these cameras cover like the perimeter of the hotel, including the front door, the back door, the lobby, the bar, the restaurant. Covers the front desk, the pool area, the exterior of the hotel, some of the parking lot, and so on. And depending on the area, some of these cameras are motion activated. Oh, and I forgot to tell you this, but the back door is alarmed. And like at night, it can't even be opened unless it's remotely opened for the front desk.
Oh, wow. That's super secure.
It's incredibly secure. Yeah. And again, like there is a security officer sitting at the front door and at the back door. I don't know what time they came on their shift, but I'm assuming it was probably like a 7 p to 7 a kind of thing, maybe. Mm-hmm. Now, unfortunately, there are no security cameras in the elevators of the hotel or in the hallways where like the guest rooms are.
That's weird.
I kind of thought, especially the elevator not having a camera was kind of weird.
I thought they just had them.
I did too. But it's explained in the 2020 episode that the lack of cameras in like these specific areas are to ensure guest privacy. But the good news is that they did have cameras pointed like right at the elevator so you can blatantly see who's getting on and off.
Okay.
So Detective Foote is super interested in seeing the security footage. So he and his team get it and they sit there and they watch the security footage frame by frame, like on the morning of Ina's attack. They also search her hotel room and they search this thing from top to bottom. They review the guest list of everyone who was staying there. Unfortunately, her room has nothing of evidentiary value. And honestly, like the guest list has hundreds, if not thousands of people on it. Like, this is a freaking airport hotel with 174 rooms. So people are constantly coming and going at all hours of the day and night.
That's like your bedroom.
Okay, to be fair, this podcast is not making any money and Louis Vuitton bags are not going to buy themselves.
You're not wrong. So
do what you got to do. No shame. Anyway, between Ina's recollection and the hotel footage, investigators can see that the night prior to her being found, she had left the hotel and gone to dinner. She returned back to the hotel around 11:45-ish that night. And Ina confirmed she had gone to dinner with a friend. They had had a couple drinks, but she wasn't drunk. And to be honest, she really didn't look intoxicated in the video.
So, I mean, so far, so good, you know, and it just basically says whatever happens happened after 11:45, like all seems normal.
Exactly. So then the security footage, like after she's back from dinner, 11:45, she goes up to her room. And then the security footage shows her coming to the lobby a few times. Like, remember, this girl has been cooped up in this hotel for a while. She's clearly bored. She's like hanging out at the front desk or talking to an employee. She's outside smoking a cigarette. She's back up in her room, like so on and so forth. And then the camera shows her leaving out of the front door of the hotel around 3:30 a.m. and then returning through the same door at 3:41 a.m. And Ina explains that she had run across the street to buy a phone card so that she could call her mom, who was back in Ukraine.
That seems like, why aren't you sleeping at 3:45 a.m.? Like, nothing good. They always say nothing good happens after midnight, but also, why do you need a phone card at 3:45 in the morning? I couldn't wait till morning.
So I kind of thought that that was strange, too, but I Googled it, and Ukraine is 6 hours ahead of Miami. So if it's 3:30 a.m. there, it's like, or I'm sorry, if it's 3:30 a.m. in Miami, it's 9:30 a.m. there.
Okay. Well, that checks in.
Yeah. And like in the 2020 episode, even Ina says she would call her mom in the morning a lot. So it's just morning time for her mom. It worked out. Mm-hmm. So they have Ina on camera waiting for, like, after she returns from the phone card, they have her on camera waiting for and then getting into the elevator around 3:41 a.m. The next time anyone lays eyes on her is like 4.5, 5 hours later, when that power company worker found her battered naked body in that undeveloped lot. So police keep watching these security tapes, but they're not much help other than showing a ton of guests who, like, the police unfortunately don't have the time, the money, or the manpower to chase down every single hotel guest and question, like, every single person, especially in Miami, where unfortunately, like, crime is prevalent.
But don't they just see her leaving the hotel after she comes back from buying the phone card?
No. She comes in from buying the phone card. She goes up to her room. They never see her again. There's absolutely no footage of her after she gets on the elevator around 3:41 a.m.
Okay.
And police check the stairwells, but all of those, like, there's cameras at the doors.
So many questions. Like, you said there's nothing in her room, but, like, you said she was also sexually assaulted. Like, do they have their suspects yet? Do they have anything to go on?
Take a deep breath, my friend.
It's insane, though, but, like, where did she go?
I know.
She had to go somewhere.
I know. Okay. So she's on the fourth floor of the hotel, and there's not a window, but there's actually a sliding door and a balcony.
Okay.
Yeah. But Detective Foote and his team, they inspect her room from top to bottom, and they even go outside and they inspect the bushes and, like, the foliage on the ground underneath her balcony.
Yeah.
And they check to see if maybe she was, like, thrown off the balcony and then transferred to a car in the dump site. Or maybe she was, like, lowered down to the ground and then transferred. But there's nothing to support these theories. Like,
it's like she's a magician. She just, like,
right.
Teleported out of it.
And it's like none of the foliage is damaged or, like, crushed. Ina, her body didn't have any rope burns or marks that would be, like, evidence towards being lowered to the ground. And for how high up her room was, it just seemed insanely implausible, especially without anyone seeing someone, like, climbing down, like, scaling a wall of a hotel.
Yeah, I feel like you would see that 4 floors up.
Right. So detectives are like, what is going on here? So they decide to search deeper into Ina's background. But they come up empty. There's, like, nothing shady. There's nothing to raise alarms.
This is so strange. I'm sorry to. This is so bizarre how this woman ended up, like, nothing going on, but then just disappeared from a hotel and ended up in a, like, a underdeveloped lot.
This case is crazy. Like, it's Rosie A. You did awesome by sending this case in. When I started reading it, I was like, how am I going to do this?
Yes. But
it's awesome. So Detective Foote and his team, they decide to go back to Ina's night before she was attacked. Investigators knew she had met a friend for dinner. Could this friend have had something to do with Ina's attack? So investigators track down her dinner companion, a man named Peter Demoulis, and they bring him in for an interview. So Peter was from Greece, but like Ina, he worked for a cruise line, so they must have been like docked in Miami at the time. And Peter tells police that on the night of her attack, yes, the duo had gone out to dinner. They actually went to the Coconut Grove neighborhood of Miami. And this is kind of like an upscale area with lots of, like, restaurants and bars. So the two of them decided to hit up some of these hotspots, and they did, like, a little bit of bar hopping. And they had a couple drinks, but by 10 a.m. they were ready to call it a night, and they hailed a taxi. So the route they took back, it actually took them to Peter's destination first. So he's dropped off at wherever he's staying. And then the cab takes Ina back to the airport Regency. And that was that. Okay. So like Peter claims, I got out of the taxi. She came back. I have nothing to do with this. But prior to investigators interviewing Peter, they had done a little bit of digging into his background and they did not like what they saw. Or maybe they did like what they saw because it was potential evidence. But right. Either way, it's bad. It's bad what they saw. Peter had actually been arrested in the months prior to Ina's attack. And the arrest record shows that he had been arrested for domestic violence. Can you guess who his victim was?
I would guess Ina, since that's the only person I know so far.
Yep. So the 2020 episode has Detective Foote talking about this arrest, and he explains that Ina and Peter had been out at a nightclub, and they had gotten into an argument. The argument was because Peter wanted to leave the club because he felt there were some, quote, unsavory characters, end quote, at this club. Ina, on the other hand, she is not ready to leave. So Peter apparently grabs her by the arm and they start arguing. And Detective Foote says that the officer working security arrested Peter for domestic violence. I don't know what ends up happening with this charge because they never talk about it again on the 2020.
Just let it go.
Yeah, it's never specified, but like I can see why Detective Foote and his team are giving Peter some major side eye.
But I'm surprised they didn't make more of a suspect out of him. They usually love to any little nugget of evil like that, they can mm-hmm. take and make a whole.
Well, and in the 2020, the reporter asks Detective Foote, she's like, so was he a suspect in your mind? And he's like, I partially considered him a suspect. Because again, the timeline doesn't really work.
Sure. That makes sense. He's a back burner suspect, we call him.
Right. But Peter wasn't the only one who was on the suspect list. So police also had to consider that maybe it was like one of those, the call is coming from inside the house situations, and maybe the rapist worked for the hotel.
Oh, maybe.
So the investigators start reviewing that security footage again, and this time they're paying close attention to like any of the hotel employees who had interacted with Ina the night of her assault. And pretty quickly, they want to talk to the hotel's night manager, a man named George Perez. So one of the reasons that George was on the list was for the simple fact that he was the manager that night and he had a master key to all the rooms. So like he could get into any room at any time, whenever he wanted. But the security footage showed an interesting interaction between Ina and George the night of the assault. So police go and talk to George, and according to Detective Foote, George begins their conversation by looking Foote square in the eye and saying, quote, oh my God, I hate cops, end quote.
Yeah, I mean, to each their own, but that's probably not how I'd go into an interview with, you know, cops.
Yeah, maybe not my first comment, but anyway. Police continue this conversation and they explain that they want to talk to him because they know he spent time talking to Ina the night of the attack.
Makes sense.
And right. And in the security footage, you can see the front desk and you can see George, but then there's like a pillar. So you can't see all of Ina, but you can see her arms moving. She talks with her arms just like me. So and because of all the other cameras and like what she was wearing, like they know it's her. So she and George are talking at the front desk, and at 2:16 a.m., George leaves the front desk with Ina, and the two of them make their way to the elevators and they get in. George is gone from the front desk for about 15 minutes. Then he walks off the elevator, he's alone, and he goes back to the front desk. So Detective Foote is like, what were you doing with Ina? Like, why would you leave the front desk unmanned and go upstairs with her? And George has an answer. He claims that, yeah, he had talked to her. Like, she had been there a while. They had kind of not become friends, but become acquaintances, friendly enough.
Sure.
So He claimed, yes, he talked to her, but nothing happened other than him doing his job. He said that Ina was a little intoxicated and he escorted her up to her room to ensure she got there safe. And like, to be fair, in the video, they don't talk about this, but it's just what I noticed. In the video, he comes back down to the front desk. He shows no signs of like just raping and attacking someone. Like his shirt and tie, or well, his shirt is still tucked in. His tie is straight. His hair's not messed up. There's no blood visible, you know? So
yeah, but you got the bigger problem is that nothing happened in her hotel room. Like there's no evidence in there.
Right.
And there's no camera footage of her leaving. So like there's a missing link here, you know? So I don't think it would be him.
Well, the only weird thing, though, is he's telling the investigators, oh, I took her up to her room because she was drunk. But remember, while Ina had been drinking while she was out with Peter, Detective Foote didn't think she looked like she was drunk in any of the camera footage. So, okay, but like, you can also be drunk and not necessarily look drunk. I don't know.
If you can just walk a straight line, they're not going to not interacting with that person and just seeing them on camera. I feel like unless they're outwardly drunk and stumbling and like, you wouldn't know.
Right. That's kind of how I feel too.
Yeah.
So now Detective Foote has two promising suspects, you know, Peter and George, and they also, you know, Detective Foote has DNA. So he asks Peter and George if they would willingly give up their DNA. Both men eagerly agree. They want to clear themselves, which to me, you generally don't expect a guilty person to like jump at the chance to give their DNA.
Right, right.
Well, when the DNA results come back, both Peter and George are cleared. Neither of their DNA matches the semen that was found inside Ina.
Not surprised.
Yeah. So now Detective Foote and his team, they need to like rethink this investigation because just like that, their two most promising leads are a bust. So their next move is to go back to the security cameras. And this time they're thinking maybe there's an issue with the cameras. Like, as I said earlier, some of these cameras were on motion detectors.
Mm-hmm.
And this next part like made me laugh. So Detective Foote and his team try to like trick the cameras, and they walk like they do all these things and they walk like super slow past the cameras and they run really fast past the camera and they like try to hide from the camera. But no matter what they do, no matter what angle they come from, these cameras record them and they're in full working order. And the reason I was laughing, like I just kept picturing all these like big bad cops like tiptoeing past the cameras with that cartoon tiptoe sound, like
tink, 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 tink.
Yes. And then I'm like picturing them like flat against the wall, sliding like against the wall with that secret agent man like playing in the background. The mental image was cracking me up.
It is pretty hilarious. At the same time, though, I mean, I appreciate the level of police work because they're trying to rule out like any possible issues with those cameras, because if and when this does go to trial, like any good defense attorney will chip away at like any lapse in the investigation or maybe any loop that the investigators didn't close. So he covered all the bases and I respect that.
He definitely did. He's clearly a brilliant detective. He does a great job. So, but at this point, weeks are going by. And soon Detective Foote and his team are out of leads and Ina's case file kind of gets pushed aside right now to gather dust. Like at this point, I'm honestly not sure if Ina is still in the hospital, if she had been discharged, but since nothing is coming from the criminal investigation, which means no criminal charges, I do know that she and her lawyer had filed a civil suit against the Airport Regency Hotel for what they claim was like a lapse in security, essentially saying that the hotel didn't keep their guests safe and like it was their fault that Ina had been attacked. And it seems like the theory there is that a hotel employee attacked Ina. And the lawyer also mentioned, I think in the 2020 episode, that some of the cameras weren't being monitored properly.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah.
But of course, the hotel isn't happy, and they're like, all right, hold on. This woman has a civil suit against the cruise line, and now she has a civil suit against us?
Yeah.
And not to mention, her story keeps changing about what happened that night. And this is like a pinkish red flag to investigators. But I also kind of think they're overlooking the fact that A, she had extensive head trauma, and B, her English is very broken. So,
well,
like,
yeah, the whole like linguistics go out the window because now you're, you know what I mean? You're trying to get to the bottom of somebody who can barely put a cohesive thought together in English. Like, you're going to have inconsistencies as they try to just explain what they're talking about.
Exactly. And I mean, we've seen this before. Like, look at the Amanda Knox trial. Like, there was an issue because she didn't understand Italian and whatever. So I don't really think this is that big of a deal, but like, I understand where they're coming from. And, but again, this is all strange to the police, and all of this is just plain shady to like the hotel people. So they, meaning the hotel, they decide to bring in a private investigator to get to the bottom of this, because of course they, A, don't want it getting out that their hotel is unsafe or like that they employ rapists. And B, they absolutely do not want to pay anyone a ton of money in a civil suit. And at this point in the game, I'm pretty sure the hotel's theory is that Ina was a sex worker. She went to a John's room. He got violent. And now she's saying it's the hotel's fault. So I feel like the hotel is trying to prove that due to her possibly being a sex worker, she brought the assault on herself, which is so problematic for so yeah. many reasons. Because regardless of your profession, you don't deserve to be assaulted.
Of course, 100% true, but sex work is illegal, you know, so Ina was probably trying to be as shady as possible if that's what she was doing and not get caught, you know, like, but did she happen to tell police at the hospital that she was in the sex industry? I'd be curious to know that, because that, like, would she readily admit that? Because that kind of changes things.
Well, she did not tell them that she was. In fact, they like should have asked her, and she assured them that she was absolutely not a sex worker.
Really? I'm dying to know the end of this case, because it is like there's so many just it's a mystery. It's one big mystery.
You have no idea. We haven't even like broken the surface of the craziness.
Insane.
But let's put crazy back seat for right now, because we're going to talk about the PI that the hotel hires. Uh-oh. And if we have a drum roll sound effect, you need to make that happen.
I can make it happen. Here we go.
I would like to introduce you to our MU MVP of my life and my latest crush, BT Dubs, private investigator Ken Brennan. All right. If you were a casting director for like Law and Order SVU and you wanted, and like the scene calls for a rough and gritty, plays by his own rules PI, you got your man. This is the man you would cast without a second question. Like, I'm going to read you the description of Ken given in the Vanity Fair article because it's freaking amazing. So they write about Ken. Ken was, quote, middle-aged, deeply tanned with gray hair. He was a weightlifter and favored open-neck shirts that showed off both the definition of his upper pecs and the bright, solid gold chain around his neck.
Oh,
the
maybe.
Look said, vomit. If listeners, stop. Listeners, Ed just tried to show everyone his pecs. I apologize to the YouTube audience. Moving on, the look said mature, virile, laid back, and making it. End quote. You can quote me on this, but if y'all are looking for a silver fox, we do not need a PI to solve that mystery, because Ken is that man. I would like him to be my man, but here we are.
I had no idea that was your type, but at the same time, I'm not surprised.
Ken has like these piercing blue eyes and like this. He's very handsome. He kind of has this like Ed Harris meets Michael Keaton look, but with like a head full of silver hair. He rides a motorcycle. His vernacular is just rife with profanities. He solves crimes and like he's like the epitome of like a man's man.
Are you done?
No, not yet, actually. in the 2020 episode, they intro him and they show him riding his motorcycle and he's got these gold chains, necklaces, and bracelets, and he's like wearing some aviator sunglasses, and he's got this like short sleeve tight shirt on highlighting his arms. Like, he looks so badass. And he's from Long Island, so of course he has that Long Island accent, which somehow just adds to his badassery.
This stopped being a crime show like 3 minutes ago.
I gotta tell you about Ken. This man is a badass. By the end of today's episode, maybe next week's, you are going to be loving Ken just as much as me, so I don't want to hear it.
I will be. I guess we will find out.
Also adding to that is that he spent years working in law enforcement. Like, he started his career in 1975 as a Long Island cop. Then he spent several years working for the DEA. And when he left the DEA, he worked as a commodities broker. And that's when he began working towards his PI license. And he found out that he didn't really like the whole broker aspect, but he loved investigating crimes. And he was damn good at it. This man has that special sixth sense that I think helps make a good investigator. He could look at you and size you up pretty damn quickly. And if he liked you, you had a badass wingman for life. If he didn't like you, oof, he would make that clear. And just a side note, Ken did have kids, but they were like grown and like out on their own. And their mother, who is Ken's ex-wife, she had passed away after they divorced. So he really isn't tied down to anything or any area. And that's honestly ideal for a PI.
And ideal for you, B, in case you were looking for an open appointment to polish his pecs.
I will take availability. The next open appointment. So this badass Superman, Ken Brennan, he comes in and he straight up tells like all his clients, including the airport regency, that he is going to get to the bottom of the case regardless of who is in the right and who is in the wrong. He basically tells clients, just because you're paying my bill, I'm not going to do anything that can lean in your direction, but I will get you the truth. So the first thing Ken does when he's like takes this case is he goes to talk to Detective Foote. And it is not a secret that police generally do not appreciate having a PI like all up in their business. So at first, Detective Foote isn't happy about Ken being on the case. But according to that Vanity Fair article, that feeling faded super quick, like right when Ken introduced himself. He appeals to Foote from like that cop camaraderie angle. And he explains to Foote that while he was a PI, or while he's currently a PI, he had been a cop and he had been a federal agent. And he says to Detective Foote, quote, look, you and I both know there's no fucking way you can investigate this case. Then he goes on to say, quote, I can see this through to the end. I won't step on your dick. I won't do a thing without telling you about it. If I figure out who did it, you get the arrest. I won't do anything to fuck it up for you. End quote.
I respect that, actually. It's like the ultimate kind of guy code at the end of the day, you know, because they want the same thing. They want justice. So it's awesome that they can work together. And this PI just kind of lays it out on the table. This is what I'm doing. And it's a mutual respect.
Absolutely. And like, you know, I'm reading this and just loving it. But apparently it appealed to Detective Foote as well, because he did something that he had like never really done before. And he agreed to share his case file on Ina with Ken. And in the 2020 episode, Detective Foote's interviewed and he talks about his general feelings about PIs, but how he really respected Ken's honesty, kind of like you said.
Yeah. And it shows that he has like the ultimate faith and that he does just want this solved. He has no ego to kind of get in the way. He just, if this guy wants to help and he has good intentions, then let him help. And I respect Foote for doing that too.
So Detective Foote shares with Ken, like all of the work they had already done, including the suspects they had ruled out, the bit where they tried to hide and tiptoe past the cameras, like everything they had done up until this point. And just to kind of keep our timeline straight, this is about 8 months after Ina's attack. Like, we're in early November 2005 at this point, and like Ken, that's when Ken takes the case. After talking to Detective Foot, his next move is to actually surveil Ina as well as check into her background. By now, she had been released from the hospital. I'm honestly not sure where she was staying. Somewhere in Miami for sure, but I'm guessing she didn't return to the Regency. I don't know for sure, but basically, Ken wants to find out for certain if Ina is in fact a sex worker, or like if she's caught up in some kind of scam, like with these lawsuits.
Well, and also the thing you got to think about is that she might have been wrapped up in something bigger, like some kind of crime syndicate, because it happens more than you think in those Eastern European countries and areas.
That was all definitely considered, but after investigating Ina's background and movements, Ken was like, all right, like he surveilled her for a couple weeks and he's like, she's definitely not a sex worker and she's definitely not wrapped up in anything, let alone like a big crime ring. And he's convinced pretty quickly that this attack like wasn't set up or anything like that.
This is such a strange case. It really is.
It really is. It's just so insane.
Like, what happened to this girl?
You're going to have to wait. So Ken's next move is to begin the tedious process of watching those security tapes. He watches the whole night of the attack, you know, with Ina in and out and finally getting on the elevator for the final time at 3:41 a.m. So Ken's watching this. He sees Ina waiting for the elevator. And he also sees her making small talk with another hotel guest. And this is like a tall, rather large black man. And they enter the elevator. And that's the last time Ken sees Ina. So he decides to check the hotel key card records. Every time someone swipes into a room, that swipe is tracked. So Ken knows that Ina gets on the elevator at 3:41 a.m. But when he checks the records for what time she swiped her key card to get into her room, 3:58.
So that's what, 17 minutes?
Look at you, my little mathematician. I'm so proud of you. Gold star.
It's a gap in time that needs to be accounted for. That's all I'm saying, you dick.
Anyway, yes, there was a 17-minute gap. And, like, there's no way that this elevator ride took 17 minutes unless she's, like, sucked into another dimension, like some Twilight Zone Tower of Terror shit, which, honestly, at this point, maybe that happened.
Would not surprise me at this point.
Right. So Ken has the same questions as us. He's like, what the hell happened in those 17 minutes? So he's then starting to question his own, like, determination that Ina was not a sex worker. Like, did she possibly spend those 17 minutes in a John's room and that's how she got hurt? So he digs deeper into those 17 minutes and very quickly discovers this was not the break in the case that Ken might have thought, because he finds out that the camera facing the elevator had a time delay of exactly 17 minutes. So Ken has solved a mystery, but not the case. It's like we keep taking one step forward and then a step back. So in addition to getting the case file and all those notes from Detective Foot, Ken is also given access to the report that was like written up by the hotel's insurance adjuster. Mm-hmm. And this insurance adjuster was just as confused as police were. So Ken is literally like the last hope in solving the mystery of A, who attacked Ina, and B, how the hell did she get from the hotel to the dump site?
That's what I'm dying to know.
Yep. So Ken has the same thought as investigators that they had had back at the beginning. Like, is there any possible chance that Ina was lowered down by ropes or something? So he goes out, looks where the room is, looks at like the bushes and foliage. And just like Detective Foot determined, Ken knew this was completely implausible.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a rapist, not a Cirque du Soleil performer, you know, with these ropes and pulleys and catapults. And
exactly. Like, that's not going to happen. Right. So At this point, Ken is like, all right, unless Harry Houdini and Chris Angel helped Ina disappear, like, she had to have left through the front door. How else would she have gotten out?
But there's a camera on the front door.
Hold on. Ken's like, holy shit. What if she left in a disguise? So he goes back to the security footage and he watches every single frame. He watches as people walk from the direction of the parking lot or like get out of their shuttle at the main entrance. He watches them come through the front door, watches them walk across the lobby, then walk to the elevator, like so on and so forth.
This is an example of why cases take so long to solve. Like, this is just one task in a humongous investigation. So seriously stop and think about how long it would take Ken to do what he's doing.
And he's one guy. And I don't know if he was like working on anything else at the time. I'm going to assume he was not, but it really never comes up.
But this is that CSI effect where things just, things happen in 30 seconds. They get results. It's like, no, these things take tedious amounts of time.
And I talk about that later in this case when it comes to like DNA results and stuff. Like in the TV shows, they press one button and it's like ding, 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 ding. When in real life, it takes months.
Yeah.
So after watching all this, pretty soon, Ken can begin crossing out people who came in the hotel and then left like after Ina was found. So then he begins crossing out people who aren't carrying anything. Like they're not carrying a bag or if they've got a super teeny tiny bag. And he's also looking for anyone who is like acting strange or shady or nervous. And actually, until he can confirm their departure time, like he's not even eliminating families with kids or like little old ladies. Yeah. Everyone is a suspect until he can account for the time that they left the hotel. This is obviously very tedious research, but Ken does it, and he can eventually determine that Ina did not leave in a disguise. Like, there was not a single person who he couldn't pinpoint the time they got there and then the time they left.
Hmm.
And pretty soon, he's left with only one person, that tall, large black man that I mentioned earlier. He's the one who had gotten on the elevator with Ina at 3:41 a.m. So Ken watches the scene again, and he watches as the two of them exchange what he assumed to be like pleasantries or small talk while waiting for the elevator.
Mm-hmm.
And he watches them get in the elevator, and he just like analyzes this scene over and over. And he's trying to decide if Ina and the guy know each other or have like any possible connection.
Yeah.
But after he rewatches for the zillionth time, he just doesn't get the feeling that their exchange was anything more than like a, how about that weather we're having? So he watches for the man to leave via the elevator. And actually, at 5:28 a.m., that same morning, the man is shown on security footage walking out of the elevator with a small suitcase.
You know, see, I didn't want to say it because it didn't make sense to me. I was going to say, was she stuffed in a piece of luggage? But that theory went out the window because she's alive.
You so, shut your mouth and hold on.
All right.
And like, there's no question it's the same guy that Ina got in the elevator with. Like, this dude, you're not going to get him confused with someone. He's huge. He's super tall. Like Ken says in one of the articles that he thinks the guy's about 6'4". And this gentleman is pretty wide. Hmm. Like we're talking over 300 pounds.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he's a big dude. And he's like a very light-skinned African-American man. And he wears black, like framed glasses.
Okay.
So Ken watches him exit the elevator at 5:28 a.m., less than 2 hours after he and Ina were seen getting on the elevator at 3:41 a.m. So when this man exits the elevator, he has a small wheeled suitcase with him, and he is cool, he is calm, he is casual.
See, now I'm interested now. The suitcase thing has me intrigued because like either one, he's checking out or going somewhere and it's seriously like just a suitcase and it's another dead end, or Ina was in it. And but it, it explains why she was never seen after 3:41 a.m. But at the same time, she's alive. Like, I feel like she would have to be in pieces, for lack of a, not to be unsympathetic, but in pieces to fit in a suitcase.
I get where you're coming from. You're just going to have to wait and see. So Ken's watching this guy. He gets out of the elevator. He makes his way through the lobby with the suitcase rolling along behind him the whole way. And he walks out that front door. So Ken continues watching the tape. And pretty soon, literally less than an hour later, the big guy is back. And he's on the security footage. He walks like they can see him coming from the parking lot. He walks in through the front entrance, walks across the lobby, and he gets back in the elevator. But Ken notices that this time, the man doesn't have his suitcase. And yeah, the wheels in Ken's head are turning. And he's like, why would this man, who definitely didn't check out that day, why would he leave so early with a suitcase, but then like return a short time later without the suitcase?
Yeah, it's definitely odd. And at the very least, something that's worth investigating.
For sure. So he investigates it and goes back to the security tapes. And he knows he is just missing a piece of the puzzle. Like, he's like, this is important, but I have to figure out why. So he watches and watches. He rewinds the footage. He fast forwards. He watches the same clips for hours. And finally, he sees something that honestly most people would never ever notice in a billion years. As this guy gets off the elevator, his suitcase wheels get caught on like the elevator door jamb, like the space between the elevator floor and the actual floor. Right. And while it only catches for a quarter of a split second kind of thing, Ken catches this and notices that the man has to give the suitcase a very small but aggressive yank to get it across the threshold.
So it's heavy.
It is. And there is no way that a man of this guy's size and stature should have any problem pulling like a normal size suitcase full of clothing and whatnot. So as Ken watches this, he has his Eureka moment. Ina is in the suitcase. That is how she, air quotes, vanished from the hotel. And just then, as he watches the clip play, and he watches our suspect stroll through the lobby, another thought strikes Ken. This guy has done this before. There is absolutely no way that a first-time rapist could be that casual and that carefree. This man attacked Ina, put her in the suitcase, rolled her through the lobby, transported her to that undeveloped cul-de-sac, and dumped her. Ken knew he had to have other victims. And he's confident in this theory, but he's still a little concerned about the suitcase because it really was small. Like, how could a grown woman, even a petite woman like Ina, like, how could a grown woman possibly fit in that suitcase?
I'm picturing this, the luggage I carry, and like the carry, the bigger suitcase maybe, but if it's as small as you're saying, like, she would have had, like, I hate to say it, but like I said, in pieces. But we know that's not the case because she lives. So like,
so she's alive. Yep.
Yeah. Weird.
Well, Ken decides to take some measurements. So he figures out like how big the floor tiles are and how wide like the hotel carpet runner is and how tall the elevator doors are and like so on and so forth. And he realizes that while the suitcase is small, it's really not that small. Like compared to our ginormous suspect, the suitcase just looks small. Like, it's totally, like, a depth kind of, like, your eyes playing a trick on you thing. Like, it ends up being an actually pretty standard suitcase. Ken measures a similar suitcase in the 2020 episode, and it's, like, a little bit bigger than a carry-on, actually, which, according to Google's AI overview, most airlines, they say the standard carry-on size is 22 inches tall and 14 inches wide.
That's right.
Well, the suspect's suitcase was actually 29 inches in height and 19 inches across. So it's seven inches tall.
That's a full-size suitcase.
Right. So it's a decent sized suitcase, but like you watch the video and it does look really teeny tiny.
It's like that guy who Jeff, I can't remember his last name, but he's got some kind of deformity, but his arms are, he's got these big hands and forearms. When he drinks a can of Coke, it looks like it's this big in his hand, but it's actually a full size thing of Coke, but you're all thrown off because of how gigantic his arms are.
Oh, that's wild. That's so crazy. The whole time I kept thinking of the Tommy Boy moment where he's like, fat guy and a little coat.
There's nothing deceptive about that, though. That's just a legit fat guy in a tiny coat.
But it still made me giggle. So Ken knows he needs to test his theory about this suitcase thing. So he gets like a friend or a colleague. It's a petite woman who's has very similar measurements to Ina. She was about 5'3". And he gets a suitcase with the same measurements to the suitcase that our suspect just so casually strolled out with. And guess what? The 5'3" woman fit in the suitcase.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And so 2020 actually, right? That's how she got out of the hotel.
It makes me feel better that she wasn't like, something with the balcony. Like I was still expecting in the back of my mind something magical to happen over this balcony just because I was out of answer.
I kept thinking something was gonna happen with the stairwells. I don't know why. Like I know there's no cameras yeah. there. Yeah, but there's cameras like at each stairwell door, I guess.
Yeah. Interesting.
At this point in Ken's investigation, he calls a meeting with the hotel bigwigs, like the executives, their insurance people, the hotel lawyers, etc. Because remember, he's working for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a status report meeting, but essentially the hotel people are like, all right, bro, what are you doing to earn the money that we're paying you? So Ken explains where he's at, and he shows the bigwigs what he's discovered so far. And he shows them the screenshot of the man with the suitcase again, and he says, this is your man. Basically, the entire boardroom, like, laughs at him.
Yeah.
They just don't believe him, not only because the suitcase looks so damn small, but also because of Ina's descriptions of who attacked her.
Right, she was all over the place.
Exactly, and they point out that she said maybe it was one, maybe it was two, maybe it was three men who attacked her, and she also claimed that the men were white. She never once mentioned anything about this 6'4", 300-plus-pound black guy, and so I get where they're coming from, but Ken remains undeterred. He's like, this is your guy.
Yeah, but if he had like lighter skin, he could have easily been mistaken for white or Hispanic. And also, like, where did the guy take her? Because maybe wherever they were during that time, there were other guys there, you know, and he just happened to be the one wheeling the suitcase, like the patsy.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. That's a good point. So he explains to the boardroom, like, everything he's done to eliminate other people and how he landed on the big, bespectacled black guy. So he plays and he replays the video footage for them, like, of this guy walking out of the hotel. And he says to these important hotel people, quote, look at how cool this guy is. He just raped and beat a woman to death, or thinks he has. And it's not like he's all nervous and jittery. He's cool as a clam. Tell me the kind of person who could do such a thing and be this nonchalant. This ain't the only time he's done this. End quote.
I agree with him.
Me too. But of course, the hotel people are still not convinced. But clearly, they underestimate Ken's tenacity. So he appeals to them from a financial standpoint. They won't have to pay Ina if it's proven that it wasn't a hotel employee who attacked her. And of course, this seems to make their ears perk up.
Mm-hmm. Shocker. Remember we talked about last week, follow the money? I mean, it literally drives the entire world that we live in. So this is not a surprise.
No, it's sick, but it is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ken's primary focus is to get this rapist off the street, but just like you said, let's be real. It's all about the money to these fancy schmancy hotel executives. And after much deliberation, they do agree to Ken continuing his work on the case. So now Ken is not only determined to arrest this monstrous, brutal rapist, but also to prove that he was right. And you know what? That's where I'm going to leave you hanging.
You're kidding me.
This is where we're going to end part one.
That's a great cliffhanger. I'm not going to lie. That was pretty good.
Well, and this is even better because, like, you don't know how it ends.
No idea. I want to stuff you in a suitcase, though. I'm not going to lie. I think we have a suitcase here that I'd like to just, like, for reference, just so we can see if we can fit a grown woman into a suitcase.
I'm demanding that Brenda be there because you'll try to leave me in there. Well, I guess we'll find out next week what happens. And I can promise you that, like, if you think this case is almost over, yet again, we have barely scratched the surface. Like, it is such a roller coaster ride we're about to go on.
This is good, though. I know it sucks having to wait a week to find out, but I think that's it's a great tease and it's going to be worth the wait, it sounds like.
Well, and to be fair, this was one of your guys' suggestions, and there is no way you could tell this case in an hour. And I don't want to let our listeners down who specifically took the time to write in and name this case. So go big or go home.
Good call.
Well, listeners, we would love to hear your thoughts on this case, or at least what you've heard of it so far. You can hit us up on our socials like Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. We are at Murder Unscripted. You can email us murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com, or you can even message us through our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com. We so appreciate you guys. And until next week, be safe. Be kind, and remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
They apparently drag mini suitcases, though, behind them. Or big suitcases, in this case. They're just deceptively big. Deceptively small.
That they do. Bye!